Hello, thanks for listening to the Total Knee Tips and Pearls podcast. This is Adam Rosen, your host. I'm a fellowship-trained orthopedic surgeon who specializes in joint replacement. In these episodes, I'm going to share with you a lot of my tips and tricks and review classic articles and current implant designs. Thanks for tuning in and on with the show. Hello and welcome back. This is Adam Rosen and you're listening to the Total Knee Tips and Pearls podcast. But again, in these past few episodes, we've been talking more about the consults or diagnoses for the non-orthopedic doctor. And today I'm going to kind of wrap that up with a few kind of top consults in the hospital, in the ER, in the urgent care, and just kind of review, you know, some basic concepts and things that, you know, are just helpful to expedite the appropriate care of the patient. But for importance and severity sake, I'm going to start with the most severe and the biggest issue thing that we need to worry about is compartment syndrome. So this is something that occasionally, you know, I'll get consults when patients are in the ICU, in the hospital more often than not. These are, you know, consultations for people that are actually in the urgent care or in the ER. And I just want to really make it important. And again, it's this catch-22 because we don't want to say, you know, only in the worst of worst cases, consider it and don't call us for, you know, every lump and bump and painful limb. But therein lies the risk that somebody could be sent home that truly has it. But you also have to understand that if they do have it or you think they have it, this is not an outpatient workup. And the reason I bring this up is there was a patient recently where, you know, they were seen over the weekend and sent home. And, you know, in the documentation and the electronic medical record note to me was, you know, saw a patient, thought he may have developing compartment syndrome, recommended that he follow up with you on Monday. And luckily for the patient, they did not have compartment syndrome. We did call them and have him come in first thing Monday morning, and he just came strolling in the door like nothing happened. But again, that would have potentially cost the patient his leg and, you know, definitely would have led to a malpractice lawsuit and the doctor would have lost if he truly did have compartment syndrome and he sent him home. So, you know, the things that most people are aware of, the P's, you know, typically the five P's that people are taught, pain, but specifically pain out of proportion, pallor of the limb, just decreased color, sometimes even poikilothermia, which some people refer to as six P's or seven P's, depending on which place you're reading, decreased temperature, paresthesias, tingling numbness in the leg or limb, pulselessness, or just decreased or fainter pulsers, paralysis, which is a bad late sign, you know, and pain with passive stretch, which sometimes people, you know, the passive stretch they list as a separate sort of issue. But, you know, just understand that if you see someone whose pain is way out of proportion to their injury, maybe they do or do not have a fracture. Because if there's any, you know, injury, and this is something I'll talk about over and over again, is if you suspect an injury to the body part, get an x-ray. You know, just like if you suspect somebody's having a heart attack, you don't call cardiology without an EKG and go, they may or may not be having, you know, an MI, but can you come down and just look at them? You get the EKG first. And, you know, orthopedics, that kind of analogous thing that we need a lot of times is the x-ray. Even if the trauma is mild, you know, you don't know if they had some sort of bony lesion from a tumor that they broke through with very minimal trauma or even no trauma. So the x-ray is really, really helpful. But that pain is out of proportion. And then the other thing, that limb is firm. You know, it's very, there's a lot of pressure there. And it's not just, you know, tender to the touch. I mean, these are people that almost jump when you touch them. It is important to understand that in the acute setting, you know, this, again, is a call. There are people that can get, you know, chronic or what we call exercise-induced compartment syndrome. This is a much less severe sort of presentation, usually exacerbated by exercise relieved with rest, and that's something separate. But, you know, when we come down and evaluate these, you'll hear about people measuring compartment pressures, and although that can be done and is still done, sometimes in questionable circumstances, more often than not, it's going to be a clinical judgment call because, you know, if we wait and delay, we could kill the muscle and that could lead to significant disability of the limb. So we're going to make that decision. The other important thing from the medical aspect, though, is, you know, are they on a blood thinner? You know, and is this patient on warfarin? Is their INR 7? But even if they're not on warfarin or some other, you know, anticoagulant, you know, what are they on? You know, is there a way to reverse the drug that they're on? You know, and that may be playing a factor if they have an evolving hematoma, which can lead to a compartment syndrome. So definitely just be aware. And this is one of those things that this is not the patient that you kind of let sit and kind of check on it. This is when you got to check, evaluate, you know, assess. Because if it's not, you know, work up the other diagnoses or differentials. But if it is and you suspect it is, you know, get the appropriate studies, labs, imaging, and then call ortho and let them make that final decision. Next things, but definitely on a much less severe thing, which is a very common issue, is cellulitis as one aspect. There's a little spin-off that I'll talk about briefly, though, and this is, you know, dog bites, which are, you know, a very, very common phone call that we get. Unfortunately, you know, we get these phone calls late where the patient's been, you know, in and out of the ER a couple times, and just because it was a little pinhole, they didn't really think it was that big of a deal. And more often than not, unfortunately, I see people placed on the wrong antibiotics. You know, so we want to make sure that we're covering the appropriate bacteria flora from the dog. You know, best drug out there is going to be orally Augmentin. So even if you're a primary care doctor and, you know, patient presents to your office, you know, don't put them on Keflex. You're not going to cover enough. And even the most innocuous looking hole can be a deadly problem if it's gotten into the tendon and then it's gotten into the joint and it's gotten deep and now it festers. And that's more often where we get called 3, 5, 7 days later and now the patient has a deep abscess that requires surgical debridement, where sometimes a simple irrigation debridement initiating the appropriate antibiotics usually can treat these, you know, quite well. But you want to make sure that, you know, you're assessing these and treating them aggressively and early. Because the rare form and the thing that, you know, I think we most commonly get phone calls for where there's really not much we can do is just basic cellulitis. You know, whether or not this is cellulitis from, you know, a cut, a scrape, whether or not they had cellulitis because they have venous stasis changes, but they had some sort of injury to the skin, they developed cellulitis, and it's, you know, consult ortho. There's not much that we can do. You know, so the reality is that if someone has cellulitis, it's a medical treatment. You know, it's treating the wound locally if it's superficial. And if there's not a wound and they just develop cellulitis, it's antibiotic treatment. So when is it best to call orthopedics and what really helps us? Well, the thing that we can do surgically is, you know, do they have a fluid collection? Do they have an abscess? Is there something to surgically drain? And the way to really figure that out is to get some imaging. So with an ultrasound is going to help tell, you know, there's soft tissue swelling, no abscess, not much for us to do surgically. Or an MRI, you know, soft tissue inflammation, no abscess, no compartment syndrome, no abscess, no dog bite, nothing to do surgically. That's a medical treatment, so IV antibiotics. However, if they do have some sort of abscess, you know, then the question is there something to be done to drain that? And also, more importantly, to determine the bug. So that's where I think ultrasound's very helpful, because if you have a good radiology department and a good ultrasound team and doctors, you know, you can coordinate with them and say, hey, I'm sending this patient down. They have cellulitis. I think they have an abscess. If they do, can you drain it? And leave a drain in, or at least drain it and get us a specimen. So a lot of times they like to leave the drains in, at least at our institution, if we're sending them down for that. But that's really helpful because, you know, now the patient's avoided a general anesthetic. You know, they go down to IR, either ultrasound. They may choose to then transfer them over to CT, depending on the radiologist's preference. And then if they do find a fluid collection, they can drop a drain in it. They can get a sample. They can send it to the lab. You can get bacterial sensitivities. And the patient has been treated. And that may be the most quick, efficient, effective, you know, less invasive than going to the operating room with an anesthetic, you know, in an open incision, which definitely in a high-risk patient, you know, may be an issue with wound healing versus a little pinhole. So definitely, you know, consider cellulitis consults to ortho. You know, ask yourself the question, is there something that a surgeon can do surgically? You know, can I prove that there is a abscess with some sort of imaging, you know, more commonly like an ultrasound, MRI, CT, sort of another option, but again, a lot of radiation, and you may do better with one of the other modalities first. And then, you know, whether or not is the patient even safe for surgery, maybe you have a good radiology department, is there an option to go to radiology first and see if we can kind of treat that? When we talk about fractures, this becomes sort of the third topic. And I, for most of you, this is going to sound silly, but the reality is we need an x-ray. So, you know, you get phone calls from the ER, from the floor, And I'll kind of lump into that, you know, also fractures and hip shoulder dislocations, you know, calling us and saying, hey, I think this patient's got a fracture. Okay, what's the x-ray show? Oh, I didn't get an x-ray yet. Or I think this patient may be dislocated. Okay, what's the x-ray show? Is it out or in? Oh, I didn't get an x-ray yet. 99% of the time, that phone call doesn't help us. It's great if maybe there's a shift change and you think maybe docs are leaving. And yeah, it's great if I'm walking out the door and someone calls me and I might be like, okay, yeah, let me come up there and let's get the x-ray done before I plan on leaving, getting a phone call in 20 minutes to turn around and come back. That is the one time where I go, oh, okay, it's helpful because I was just about to walk out the door. But 99% of the other time, you know, if someone comes in, get an image, you know, don't just tell me that the leg looks bad or the wrist looks bad. Okay, it could be swelling, could be hematoma, probably fracture. But what I'm going to do for the patient, how I'm going to treat them really depends on the x-ray, especially in a shoulder or a hip. Like if they do have a fracture and a dislocation, you know, that may completely change the way that we manage these things. So some dislocations can be straight dislocations and you can reduce them. But some dislocations may be associated with a fracture where you could actually do more harm. So you want to make sure that you have the appropriate test. Again, I lead this back to the analogy of you don't call cardiology and say, I think someone's having an MI, because they walk in the door and you get the EKG. So someone walks in the door and you think they have a fracture, they think they have a dislocation. Again, I know this sounds silly to the majority of you listening, but you would be surprised how many orthopedic surgeons will tell you they get phone calls all the time for someone suspecting a fracture dislocation and no one has ordered an x-ray. So just get the x-ray. It really, really helps us. Okay, so let's go on. So next topic, infections and antibiotics. So this is a thing, and again, I would strongly recommend you talk to your local orthopedist to make sure everyone's on the same page. But I would tell you that every orthopedic surgeon that I know feels the same way, that if you have somebody that comes in and you suspect that they have an infection and the patient is medically stable, do not give them antibiotics until we get a specimen. Because if you give them antibiotics and now they have high-dose IV antibiotics on board for a while and the specimen does not grow anything, we do not know what we are treating, which then relinquishes the person to be on broad-spectrum antibiotics for a longer period of time. Whereas if we know the exact bacteria species and with sensitivities can isolate that species and its best drug, we can then narrow it down to one drug for that patient if possible. So when somebody comes in, you know, the things that we're looking for and thinking about, you know, CBC is helpful, you know, for multiple reasons, but definitely if the white blood count, white blood cell count is elevated, that's helpful. Sometimes, you know, some of these, you know, abscesses, joint infections, we don't always see a huge rise in the white count early on. A SED rate and a CRP are extremely helpful because, again, you know, white blood cell count, SED rate, CRP, all normal. The suspicion for infection is quite low. In a joint, you know, always consider adding in a uric acid. You know, we're going to get crystals on the aspirate to really prove or disprove that the patient does or does not have gout because, you know, gout or a pseudo-gout presentation in a joint can very significantly mimic an infection. But obviously not the best treatment to then take that person to the operating room and wash them out. And the other thing, though, is, you know, checking for the area of concern because, you know, if it's in a joint, not all ER doctors I've found are comfortable aspirating it. If it's an abscess on a hand or leg, you know, same sort of deal. I've had the phone calls of, you know, well, I think they have an abscess or I think they have a, you know, joint infection, but, you know, I didn't want to put a needle in it because I didn't want to cause an infection. They like, no. If you think they have an infection, the best thing that you could do for that person is put a needle in it because one, if they do have an infection, you're initiating treatment. And two, if they do have an infection or don't have an infection, you're diagnosing it. That's going to be up to the individual listening to this podcast and then your comfort level. I would strongly recommend that if you're in that environment where you are potentially going to be seeing people with these problems, and you're not comfortable, you know, talk to your local orthopedist and say, hey, give me, you know, some tips and pointers on how do I aspirate these safely? And then what should I send? Because that's the most important thing, which I wanted to get to is that, you know, more often than not, somebody does a great job by sticking a needle and gets a specimen, but they don't send it off for the right stuff. And now I get a phone call 24 hours later and I got to stick the person again because, you know, what we're looking for is the cell count, The cell count is extremely helpful. Whether or not this is a native virgin joint or a joint that has a joint replacement or just a routine abscesses, you know, that cell count is going to tell us a lot about whether or not this is infected even before cultures come back. And then the cultures are really, really helpful to, again, identify the bug. You know, typically if we're concerned, depending on the patient and the presentation, you know, aerobic and anaerobic cultures, fungus and AFB, you know, they're really, really helpful. The one thing that we're seeing more commonly in orthopedics now, more commonly in the shoulders, but in lots of joints too, is this Pyacnes infection. But those are difficult to grow in the first couple days, and most, you know, labs will culture out for 3 to 5. You know, those you specifically have to write on to hold for 14 days on your anaerobic cultures. And the other important thing with all of these is adding in, you know, crystals, because again, if somebody presents with a red, hot, swollen joint and they have gout or pseudogout, the treatment is extremely different than it is if they have an infection. So we always want to kind of rule that in or rule that out. And then we can then make a decision. If you've identified a bug and the patient is going to go to the operating room, especially if the patient is septic, then it's a great time to initiate antibiotics. You know, but if we're suspecting infection, you know, we have an inadequate specimen, then we may want to decide on when we give those antibiotics in relation to the operating room to give us the best chance of success for identifying the organism. But, you know, just keep in mind that if you see somebody and you think they have an infected knee, shoulder, abscess, if they're stable, hold off on antibiotics, at least until you talk to the orthopedic surgeon and say, hey, you know, this is what I got. Do you want me to give them antibiotics now? They may say yes. If the patient's septic, just give them the antibiotics. But it's great if you can get a specimen cleanly prior to the initiation of the antibiotics. Next things I want to talk about is, and this is more for the sort of inpatient hospitalist, but when we talk about hospitalists following our post-op surgical patients, things that are still commonly done that tend to offer very little in the way of helping diagnose or treat patients, and also tend to utilize a lot of healthcare resources and dollars. So if you're not familiar with, you definitely should familiarize yourself with the chest guidelines. And, you know, one of the things that came out in the last set of chest guidelines, again, is the idea of they recommend against routine ultrasounds for postoperative patients. And I see this more commonly, I'll tell you, to be honest with you, patients come in with hip fractures and they seem to be like routinely ordering ultrasounds on every patient that comes in. Now, previously, this was a thing because patients, or hospitals rather, were always afraid of getting dinged for an in-hospital ultrasound positive for DVT, and even nursing homes. So a lot of them would require ultrasounds prior to transfer because, again, they didn't want to get dinged. They wanted to prove it happened in the hospital. But it is important to understand that if somebody comes in with a new injury, there's no indication for routine ultrasound. So if you suspect that somebody has acute pain, swelling with risk factors, you know, then there's an indication for the ultrasound. But don't just get routine ultrasounds just because somebody had surgery or had an injury. That's kind of number one of these, you know, common post-surgical sort of things. Number two, post-operative anemia and CAT scans looking for bleeding. You know, this is a common thing that we tend to still see, which is, you know, waste of time and, you know, exposes patients to a lot of radiation. So if somebody has lost a unit or two of blood after a routine orthopedic surgery, for the most part, major surgeries, you know, patients that are in the hospital, we're talking, you know, hip fractures, shoulder replacements, knee replacements, hip replacements, some big spine operations, a gram or two, more often than not, they're bleeding where we just did surgery. So if a knee replacement was done yesterday and they're swollen and they have a, you know, 1 gram, 2 gram drop in their hemoglobin, that is within normal limits. You get the CAT scan and then call us to say the CAT scan report came back from the radiologist and they saw a large hematoma in the knee. And again, I think for the majority of you listening, you're going to go, yeah, no duh. But we get these phone calls all of the time. And my patients get whipped down to CT and then, you know, get exposed to a lot of radiation for something that we already know the answer to. Yeah, they do have blood in their joint because I took a saw and a drill to the end of their knee and they're going to bleed. It's normal. And the 1 or 2 grams is normal. But are they hypotensive? Are they lightheaded? Are they dizzy? Are they symptomatic from the anemia? And if not, we don't have to go crazy. You know, it's different, obviously, in the spine world. Somebody has a new onset neurologic deficit with anemia. Then that's a different story. We're looking for hematoma specifically pressing on some neural structure. But for the most part, pain, swelling, 1 or 2 gram normal postoperative anemia. There's no need to rush into the CAT scan on the operative limb. Check with your orthopedic surgeon. 99% of the time, they're going to go, no, no indication. Don't get it. It's normal. It's expected. Next thing, postoperative white blood cell elevation. You know, one of the reasons that, you know, I stopped doing routine lab draws, CBCs and HNHs, was because of the advent of this new use of transuxamic acid. You know, we stole this from the cardiothoracic surgeons, and in our world and literature for knee and hip replacements, it's really been shown to statistically decrease the need for postoperative transfusions, which is great for patients for multiple reasons. But we found, you know, our rates were around 20% transfusion rate prior to the initiation of TXA, and now less than 1%. So we know that if someone has a, you know, hemoglobin of over 11.5, and they're undergoing routine total joint replacement with TXA, the chance of needing a transfusion is extremely low. But years ago, you know, I used to order CBCs on everybody. Why? Well, that's what we did. And they were on enoxaparin. We were worried about platelets. We were worried about blood loss and anemia. And attached to that was the white blood cell count, which wasn't very necessary. When we stopped using enoxaparin, I had no concern in a particular patient to look at platelets. They had a routine joint. I wasn't interested in their white blood cell count. We started doing HNHs. Why? Well, it's cheaper. And it gave me the information that I need. Does this patient have postoperative anemia that's significant and matched with their symptoms if they were hypotensive or had other issues? But when people are doing routine CBCs normally and hospitalists see the white blood cell count elevated after routine orthopedic surgery, there are still many times where the knee-jerk reaction is pan culture. Blood cultures times two, chest x-ray, UACNS, a lot of money and a lot of, you know, trauma to the patient. This patient's been whipped around the hospital, they get a chest x-ray, they have to pee in a cup, they have blood cultures, you know, done in the right arm, then done in the left arm, and 99% of the time, if not 100%, they're going to be all normal. So just understand that there is a shift, there's a leukocytosis, there's a stress response after all of these large orthopedic surgeries, and just because you see this elevation in the white blood cell count, there's not a reason to pan culture these patients. I think the other factor that used to be a huge issue with this was also the postoperative fever, which we also know is very common in postoperative patients. Nowadays, with many people going to the scheduled non-narcotic pain regimens, specifically, you know, the use of scheduled acetaminophen, there have actually been some studies that have shown that the postoperative fever has been diminished, if not eradicated. So, you know, I'm hoping that even if you are having a hospital that does CBCs routinely for your post-op orthopedic surgery patients, and they're on acetaminophen to avoid the use of excessive narcotics, you may not see the fever, and maybe there's not as much of a knee jerk in an afebrile, asymptomatic patient with just a white blood cell count. But don't routinely pan culture. And if you see the elevated white blood cell count, even if they have a low grade temp, you know, again, talk to your surgical team and say, hey, I saw this and this. Do you believe that there's a reason that we should pan culture this patient? Because for routine cases, the odds are the answer is going to be no. The last thing I'll sort of, you know, leave you with, and again, it's one of those things which I see commonly on postoperative patients. And again, 99% of you listening are going to kind of shake your head and go, yeah, no duh. But, you know, for the 1% of you that, you know, aren't thinking this, is that if you have somebody that is short of breath or swollen, you think they have a PE, you think they have a DVT, and they're post-surgical, do not order a D-dimer. You know, D-dimer is great in the patient walking into your urgent care who you suspect may have a PE, DVT prior to getting the CT or the ultrasound. If you suspect a patient has a PE in a post-surgical patient because they're hypoxic and tachycardic, you know, the best thing typically is to initiate treatment and then work it up. You know, obviously talk to your surgeon and find out, you know, whether or not it's safe to anticoagulate that person. But for me, if I have that suspicion, I'm initiating treatment and then ordering the CT. But when you order the D-dimer in a postoperative patient, it's always going to be positive. So again, it's another lab draw, it's another stick, it's another waste of money because the information does not help you make the diagnosis. So all of these things, you know, I hope a lot of these things, you know, ring true. If there is something that you haven't thought of before, or maybe something that you kind of have thought of, but you know the knee-jerk reaction is to do something else, if anything, I just hope this makes you think twice before either instituting a treatment or not, you know, just kind of making sure that you're doing the appropriate thing for the patient under the appropriate circumstance. But again, if there are questions, and please, definitely, if there are other topics that you would really like to hear that you find to be helpful, again, orthopedic topics for the non-orthopedic specialist that may help you in the office, that may help you in the ER, the urgent care, in the ICU, on the floors, please, you know, let me know, email me, DM me. I'd like to do some other episodes on those topics before, you know, we kind of get back into the orthopedic swing of things for all the orthopedic surgeons, residents, and fellows. And again, if any of these past few episodes and topics have been helpful to you and you have other colleagues that you really believe may benefit from some of this information, please forward the information on to them. If you can, leave a review. That's really helpful for other people finding this information and finding the podcast. And once again, you've been listening to Adam Rosen on the Total Knee Tips and Pearls podcast, this season 3, which has been geared for the non-orthopedic provider. Until next time, stay safe. You've been listening to the Total Knee Tips and Pearls podcast. Make sure that you're subscribed so you'll be notified of future episodes. And please take the time to leave a review. It helps other people like you find the show. Until next time, stay safe.